welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and or about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Greer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight in studio, we have Deb and Andre. Together for 26 years, we met them at Fountain Grove Lodge. And after getting to know them, we discovered they are both doctors. And of course, we wanted to know more. So we invited them to the show.
Deb is a general pediatrician at Sutter Health in San Francisco. And Andre, before retiring... That's a good one, huh, Andre? And before retiring, Andre was the director of pharmacy at Sutter Health. And we want to welcome you both to the show.
Hey there. Glad to be here.
It's a real treat to be here on the show with all of you.
So before we get to know more about them and hear about their lives and how they navigate the world, here is news and events with Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Moralia.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of July 7th, 2019. Father Manuel La Rosa Lopez of the Galveston-Houston Archdiocese in Texas was recently charged with sexual abuse of a minor for allegedly exposing himself to an unnamed 15-year-old who came out to him as gay during confession in the year 2000. According to KXXV.com, the minor alleges that after confessing his homosexuality to the priest, La Rosa Lopez asked him vulgar questions and proceeded to open the partition window in the confessional booth and exposed himself. The victim spoke about the incident in a session with a therapist in 2017, according to the lawsuit. KXXV added that Rosa Lopez has now been indicted on 5 charges involving 3 alleged sexual abuse victims. Earlier this month, Bishop Thomas Tobin, a Roman Catholic leader whom by his own admission ignored incidents of child abuse when they occurred in his church, tweeted, quote, "Catholics shouldn't support or attend LGBTQ Pride Month events held in June. They promote a culture that encourages activities that are contrary to the Catholic faith and morals, and they are especially harmful for children," end quote. But despite the bishop's urging, Pride celebrations to mark the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots did happen last weekend in cities across the United States, including in New York, where World Pride was celebrated. The governor of Illinois signed an executive order to help protect transgender students on the day that Chicago's Pride Parade was scheduled. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed an order on Sunday creating a task force to address transgender student needs in schools. 25 people will be appointed to the task force that will study what schools are doing in the state to be affirming and inclusive of transgender, non-binary, and gender non-conforming students. Their report will be due in January of next year. The governor said, quote, "This executive order is one more step towards securing Illinois' place as a leader in equality and hope. Under this executive order, ignorance is no longer an excuse for bigotry," end quote. And here in the Bay Area, last Sunday's 49th annual LGBTQ Pride Parade in San Francisco kicked off at 10:30 a.m., but was quickly halted by a very small group of protesters who sat down in the street and blocked the parade route. The protesters used rainbow-colored tubes to lock their hands and arms together, making it more difficult for police to remove them. They were protesting the presence of corporations and police at the Pride Parade. After some negotiations, San Francisco police and Pride organizers convinced the protesters to get up and leave the parade so it could resume, with over 280 contingents lined up waiting to march, including a large contingent of LGBTQ and ally law enforcement officers from all over the Bay Area. Police chiefs from Berkeley, Hayward, and Healdsburg marched with San Francisco PD's command staff. Richmond police were well represented as well. For the first time in history, California's governor participated in the parade. Governor Newsom was joined by Senator Kamala Harris and Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia.
And And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diane and Sheridan, and I'm Sheridan. In studio tonight, we have Deb and Andre, together for 26 years, both doctors in San Francisco. Well, Andre's retired now, so we're going to find out more about that in a minute. But they are our guests tonight, and again, we want to welcome you both to the show.
Great. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to be here with you today.
Wonderful. All right, so let's start with you, Deb. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I was born in Dallas, Texas. Went to medical school there as well. Decided that Houston, where I went to medical school, was not necessarily the right place for me, given my my coming out and not wanting to be ostracized. So I moved to San Francisco and started my pediatric residency there at California Pacific Medical Center. And that's where I met Andre, and we got married, and here we are.
Well, that was a long story in a nutshell, I bet, huh?
Exactly, yes. I left out a lot of parts, obviously.
Yeah, we will get to those for sure. Right. You've been just focusing on medicine for, when did you start?
I started my residency in 1989. I started medical school in 1985. I was in college, and I actually really was a business and psychology major. I didn't have an interest in medicine at the time. And once I graduated from college, I tried odds and ends. I went to graduate school for social work, and that lasted about one semester. And I realized that was not my cup of tea. And yeah, I did a lot of exploring and eventually realized that I did indeed want to become a physician. Part of that was I was doing research at the time at MD Anderson Hospital in Houston, and we were studying this very strange sarcoma that was affecting gay men. And I knew that I needed to either go on and get my PhD to continue research or get my MD degree. And I chose to go to medical school because I wanted to actually be able to take care of patients instead of just do bench research. So that's kind of how I got started.
Mm-hmm. Wow, wonderful. Thank you. Andre, what about you? Tell us a little bit more about you.
I was born in upstate New York. Went to Montreal. My mother's a French Canadian. I went to Montreal when I was about 15, finished school there. I went on and did my undergraduate at McGill University there in Montreal. And this was very much at the time when all the psychedelic drugs came out and people were throwing themselves off roofs and porches because they felt they could fly. And I lost one of my friends who was living in the dorm with me. She felt she could fly that day and jumped off the deck of her third floor room in the dorm and promptly died, of course. Mm. So I felt that at that time I really wanted to better understand the drugs, and what better thing to do than to go to pharmacy school. So I did attend the University of Montreal for a four-year and picked up my degree in pharmacy. I would like to point out that this is a strictly French-language university, and I was in Montreal during the years, what we call the Quiet Revolution, when the French wanted to secede from Canada in order to preserve their language and their culture. I became very much part of that, and to this day, all of my friends in Montreal are French-speaking. I don't think I have any English-speaking friends there. Mm. They picked up English along the way, but we still always communicate in French. I worked for several years and had my own pharmacy in the outpatient setting in Montreal, which pharmacy practice was very different there than in the United States. The pharmacist was very much involved with speaking with patients, making changes in medication dosages, and writing a note to the doctor, since we had no email in those days or texting. So you had to write a quick note and say, "Dr. Jones, I changed the insulin dose on this patient because of this or that." I did that for a few years and then decided I wanted to do something different. So I went back to school and did a residency at Laval University in Quebec City. And that was a residency that was 6 months general hospital pharmacy, and the last 9 months were pediatric specialty pharmacy. And that then determined my career path as I went forward.
Because?
I just fell in love with pediatrics and taking care of children and being part of the team that cared for children who were very sick, whether it was in the emergency department, whether it was the intensive care unit. This also involved exposure to very small infants and then the newborn intensive care unit. Once I finished my residency, I was then hired at the Montreal Children's Hospital, which was a tremendous thrill for me, and I worked there for a little bit over a year before coming back to the United States for family reasons. Came back for family reasons. My father was not well, and we determined he probably would not survive the year. I came to help my brothers out, and as luck would have it, otherwise I would never have met Debbie. He lived an additional almost 5 years.
The universe was pulling you toward
yes,
her.
Yes, it was. So needless to say, I never did return to my beloved Montreal. You know, we've been together for 26 years, and it's been just a tremendous run.
It's so interesting and wonderful getting to know you both more intimately. So yeah. Thank you for sharing your lives with us. Mm-hmm. I'm very curious about the first time you saw each other. I mean, it seems like fate has brought you together at this point. So where were you? What's the story? And perhaps you both have different memories of the story. I don't know. But Deb, can you describe the first time you saw Andre? What brought you toward seeing her that first time?
Andre was, as she said, the clinical pharmacist. I was the chief resident at the time, and so we would often do what we call clinical rounds, where we would discuss the care of each patient that was on our service at that particular time. To be quite honest with you, I had no idea that she was a lesbian. I was out at work, but she was not quite as open at that time. I really didn't notice her until the hospital was sponsoring a gay and lesbian dance, and she asked me if I was going to be going to the dance. And I'm pretty sure I was speechless. I had no clue that she would even know about this dance. And I had not planned on going to the dance because I was doing some moonlighting work to pay my medical school loans off. But in any case, I decided that I would go to the dance. And I did. And Andre also went, and unfortunately when she arrived she was with another woman, and I thought, that's not really what I had planned. I later found out that was just her ride to the dance, and I had just broken up with somebody, and I was not necessarily sure I wanted to, you know, get into a relationship or even start dating right away. But a good friend of both of ours, it was a nurse practitioner at the time, told me that if I didn't ask Andre to dance, she was going to. And so I got up my courage and asked Andre to dance. And, you know, it's history, right? I don't even remember what song we danced to, but we did have a dance, and we have been together ever since.
You have the same story, Andre?
Yeah, I definitely remember it that way. I mean, it was very clear to me. Everybody knew Debbie was a lesbian, and, you know, I went to work in skirts and stockings, and not that that was meant to be a camouflage, but I had come from an environment that was very closeted, and I had lived a very closeted life and continued that pretty much, even though I was out with some friends, but at work it was a little bit different. But yeah, I do remember saying, "Are you going to be going to the dance?" As I was leaving the pediatric nursing unit, she said, "Well, you know, I have to work tomorrow morning." I said, "Well, you know, we should all go and support this. The hospital's actually doing this for us on the Presidio, which at that time was a live Army base." So whatever the story was, in any case, I went. Sure enough, my ride, Donna, I figured that way I could have a beer and not have to worry about driving, because Donna had to work the next morning, so she wasn't going to have anything to drink. So I said, "Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you just drive me to this? You can spend the night at my house on the couch." And I was clear about that. And so that's how it happened. And then Debbie was there, and it's kind of the rest is all history.
So, Debbie, you saw Andre walk in with another woman, and you went, "Well, this isn't what I had in mind." And then you talked about having the courage to go ask Andre to dance. So when did you realize that Andre and her ride, Donna, were not a couple?
You know, I don't remember. I probably asked her, or maybe she just, I don't know. I don't remember that part of the story, quite frankly.
Blocked it out.
I blocked it out, right.
So, Andre, you must have had your eyes on Deb,
well,
right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There was a certain attraction there. But again, being very closeted, I, you know, subdued, I'm sure, a lot of that. But I think in terms of at the actual dance, Donna, my ride, and I didn't hang out together. I was hanging out with a bunch of other people, and she was hanging out with other folks. So it was clear we were friends, but that was the end of that. It was only later that I told Debbie, well, no, she's my ride. And
Okay, so you're on the dance floor and you feel the heat and the chemistry and all of that. Then what happened?
Give us a little bit more. Come on now.
All right, so I decided I would walk Debbie out to her car. So we were hugging, and of course, we pretty much wiped down the side of one side of her Bronco, you know, by just hugging and leaning against it for far too long and doing far too much. In any case, she got in her Bronco and left because my ride came by and said, we have to get home. It's late. So that was kind of how I left it.
Yeah, I was living in Alameda at the time, so I had to drive from San Francisco to Alameda, and I remember getting home. It was probably around 2 o'clock in the morning, and I had to get up at 6 to go to do my job out in Antioch. I was pretty tired, perhaps a little hungover as well. You know, I was at my job, and because I was a chief resident, I always had to have, well, we had pagers back in the day because we didn't have cell phones and all of that. So I had my pager on, and Andre, since she was a clinical pharmacist, was able to persuade one of her colleagues in the pharmacy to give out my pager number. So Andre got my pager number and paged me, and I tried to ignore it, and she in fact, I did ignore it, and then she paged me again, and I finally, you know, answered in probably a little bit of a rough manner. Andre then said, hi, this is Andre. I don't know whether you remember me or not.
You're too funny.
But of course, I did remember her, and in any case, she invited me to have dinner with her that night. So that was our official first date.
It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Very beautiful. So back in the day, we're talking in the 80s, right?
So 90.
Early 90s.
Early 90s.
Early 90s. So when you got a number that you didn't recognize, it didn't say Andre's name, right?
Right. No, it was just just
called
a number.
This number.
Yeah. Right.
That was being very persuasive, like, you know, keep calling you until you called back.
Right.
So you didn't really know who was going to be on the other end.
No, in fact, I thought it was probably going to be, you know, one of the other, you know, attending physicians or somebody that I was reporting to telling me that something was wrong.
Yeah.
And that I needed to fix it. So that's why I was a little gruff when I answered the page, because you're right, I had no idea who it was.
Yeah, so you were a little gruff when you answered the page, and then when you heard Andre's voice say, this is Andre, what happened to you at that moment? Did you melt, or?
Well, I certainly changed the tone of my voice. Yes, and yeah, I did kind of, I don't know if melt is the right word, but I did have a pretty big smile on my face.
Oh, that's beautiful.
It's really sweet. So were you both not in relationships? Was this your first? Or I'm just curious about all of that coming from Houston. And
no, it was definitely, it was not my first. As I said, I had broken up with somebody, and I kind of wanted just to...
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
Just to kind of give myself a little space, which turned out not to happen, which is... all worked out.
And so you got together, and the next step, when did you like decided to move in together? I mean, being both doctors in your schedules, and how did you work it all? How did you navigate that relationship? Even now, I mean, just kind of give us a little bit of storyline.
Well, I had about the year before with two friends had purchased a building in San Francisco. You know, I was dirt poor at that point, just beginning to get my career off the road, and the friend of mine, and I was living with her in a roommate situation, and I persuaded her to move with me to my new home, saying A, it would cost me less, and B, it would cost her less, and why don't we just do that? So indeed, Mary said, well, yeah, that makes sense. So Mary moved with me. You know, to fast forward a little bit, Mary then decided she wanted to go back to school and be a nurse anesthetist. So Debbie and I at this point were dating quite a bit, and she would stay over here and there. But the decision was that I would drive Mary to Minnesota so she could go to school with her dog. Hmm. And when I came back, Debbie could move in. So that's kind of how it worked, revolving door to a certain extent.
Well, that must have been exciting.
Yes, it was. It was very exciting. And it certainly made it easier because As I said, I was living in Alameda, and we were pretty much spending most nights together, and so either in Alameda or in San Francisco, and it just made, you know, life. I mean, it would take us about 45 minutes to commute from Alameda to San Francisco, and so, you know, it saved an hour and a half on those days when we didn't have to go to Alameda, so it was good.
Yeah, I basically said it's either me or it's Alameda, and I said, you know, I can't be doing this commute. I get car sick, so for me to have to sit in the car in the morning, is the worst. So it was a matter of, you know, just do this. I've always joked that she married me for my house. But
Well, yes. Speaking of marriage, I mean, when did that happen?
So we had been together for a while. We, you know, before marriage was legal, we did decide to become domestic partners. Because we're both in the healthcare field, we had seen many of, you know, other gay patients that, because they were not domestic partners, get denied rights such as visitation, particularly if they were family members that were not supportive of the relationship. And so we early on felt like we needed to at least have some documentation that we were together, so that if we did have any family members that weren't supportive, we could have this as an affidavit, so to speak. I mean, fortunately, our family is on both sides are very supportive, so we've never had to had the need to use anything. But yeah, so we became domestic partners first, and that was in June 1995. I don't remember what year it was when Gavin Newsom decided that he was the mayor of San Francisco, and he decided that he was going to open up the doors to gay marriage in San Francisco. And
2004, honey, we were in line there.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. We were not in line, and we kind of talked about it, and Andre basically said, I'm not going to get married until we know that it can never be taken away from us. And so even Prop 8 and all of that stuff, we never were in line. But then when the Supreme Court came down and said, you know, this should be legal throughout the United States of America, that's when we decided we would get married, and we did.
We are longtime fans and have many, many friends on the North Coast in Mendocino. We are involved with the Mendocino Coast Clinics and work with them every year when they have this large event, which is an enormous fundraiser that we attend and have, you know, managed to bring a lot of people to support this. And we both felt that that would be the place to get married. We would have a smaller wedding. We chose Little River Inn, just outside of Mendocino, and had a spectacular wedding the 27th of January, 2014, with 30 of our closest friends, family, and those who could be there. And it was spectacular.
Wow, this is a good time for our music break, and you all brought a favorite song of yours. And Deb, if you could introduce it for our listeners, it'd be great.
Sure. So our favorite song is Stay, Stay, Stay by Taylor Swift. It is our favorite song because it was our first dance when we got married. And it's not a slow song that most people do. It's actually kind of a funny song, but really goes through the years of our lives and kind of pulls together, you know, times that we perhaps were having a little bit more difficulty seeing eye to eye on some things. But as the title of the song says, we stay, stay, stay. And yeah, so that's the song.
That's when you came in wearing a football. fears, my hopes and dreams. I just like hanging out with you all the time. All those times that you didn't leave, it's been occurring to me, I'd like to hang out with you for my whole life. Stay, I'll be loving you for quite some time. No one else is gonna love me when I get mad, mad, mad. So I think that it's best if we both stay, 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 stay. I've been loving you for quite some time, time, time. You think that it's funny when I'm mad, mad, mad. But I think that it's best if we both.
If you just joined us, that was Stay, Stay, Stay by Taylor Swift, Deb and Andre's favorite song, the first song they danced to at their wedding. So, Debbie, why don't you talk to us a little bit about your childhood as far as when did you know you were lesbian? How did you tell your family? You'd mentioned in our first segment that you have supportive families, and we'd like to hear more about that.
Sure. So, as I said, I was born in Dallas, Texas. My father was a Methodist minister, or he became one shortly after my birth. And so initially we did some traveling around. We left Texas and went to Colorado and spent some time in New Jersey and St. Louis, Missouri. And it was kind of an interesting time. During school, you know, I would be in school for a year or two, and then we'd move, and I'd have another school, and so yeah, I was kind of a loner. I didn't really, you know, I had a few friends in my classes, but most of the time I kind of just did things the way that I felt like I wanted to do. I was definitely a tomboy. My mom and dad supported me in that. I knew pretty early on that there was something different about me. I didn't really know what that was. But for instance, in kindergarten, for Mother's Day, the teacher said, okay, the girls are going to make an apron for mom, and the guys got to do cutting boards for their moms. And I didn't really want to make an apron for my mother. I wanted to make a cutting board, and so I told the teacher that that's what I wanted to do. That led to a parent-teacher conference.
Oh, wow.
yeah, I guess, you know, that wasn't something that that the teacher was willing to do, and so my father went to the parent-teacher conference. My mother was taking care of my sister, who was ill at the time. My father listened to the teacher's story, and he basically said, my daughter's going to make the cutting board. Wow. He used a few words that we can't use on the air, but anyway, I made the cutting board, and my mother had it for many years after that. So that was kind of the first clue that, you know, I was different. But my dad and my mom just chalked it up to me being a tomboy. And a few years after that, we went on a skiing trip, and my father and I hired a person to give us private lessons. And we had that for an hour or two, I don't remember. But anyway, this ski instructor was just drop-dead gorgeous. And I felt madly in love. And that was probably the first time that I thought, maybe I am attracted to women. Now, obviously, she was probably, you know, in her 20s, I would imagine, you know, maybe late teens.
And you were?
I was 7.
Oh, gosh. I didn't expect that number coming from you.
No, I was 7. And at the end of the lesson, she asked my dad if she could take me up to the very top of the hill and have us ski down together. And I was just like, oh, please, Dad, please say yes, please say yes. And he did. And so we did. We managed to, you know, go up to the top of the mountain and ski all the way down. And we got in the car to go home, and my dad said, you know, we are going home. And I thought we were just going back to the hotel. So I cried all the way home from where we were in Vermont to back to our house in Summit, New Jersey. And I think both my parents realized, wow, I mean, there's one thing to have a little bit of a crush, but there's another to have, you know, a five-hour crying session over not being able to see this woman again. So that was my first inkling. My father changed. He realized that running a church was not his thing, so he became a hospital chaplain. We shortly then after moved back to Texas, to Houston. Again, you know, my parents told me that we were moving from Summit to Houston while we were in the car. I'm not sure why they were always afraid to tell me while I was at home. Maybe they thought I'd run away or something. But I was delighted because, you know, what I knew of Texas was that everybody had a horse. And so we were driving and they said, we're moving to Texas. I said, great, I can have a horse. And I eventually did get a horse. Actually, I got two of them and showed one of them quite a bit when I was younger, in my probably the years, let's see, 12, 13, 14 years of age. I showed quite a bit. Yeah, and then we kind of got into, I think, a lot of, you know, people who are discovering themselves, whether they're gay, lesbian, you know, trans, bi, I mean, all of that are certainly at increased risk for doing risky behaviors. And I got involved in that, had a little bit of trouble with the police, and spent a few hours in a holding cell with some ladies of the night. I was 16. They were definitely older than that. That was how I met my future stepfather. I got arrested for shoplifting and was taken to downtown Houston police station, strip searched, and then thrown into the holding cell. I pleaded with the officers to call my father, not my mother, because I knew my mother was not going to be, neither one was going to be happy, but my father perhaps a little bit better in terms of taking it, you know, coming down to the police station to pick me up. My father, they couldn't get a hold of him again, no cell phones, you know, so it's kind of, you know, who's at home at the time, and my mom was at home about to go out on a date with this man, and they came and picked me up, and I was in trouble for sure, but I think that they realized that I had gone through quite a bit with the drugs and the alcohol, just that I was having some emotional struggles, and so I think that probably helped me not get grounded for the rest of my life.
So your mom sounds, even though maybe she was more punitive or something over your father, but it sounds like she understood about natural consequences.
She did, yeah. I mean, I think she was not as verbal, perhaps, as my father, you know, in terms of, my father was always, you know, let's sit down and talk about it. My mother was much more, you know, get in your room kind of person, but still both very, very understanding.
Mm-hmm. Clearly, she saw something that you needed some support and some help around.
Right, yeah. Right, mm-hmm. Right.
So you said earlier when we were talking about Houston and wanting to leave there because it wasn't safe for you. So you were right. When you were in jail, that was about 16, right?
Yeah.
So what happened in between you leaving?
So my parents got divorced. The divorce judge asked me which parent I wanted to stay with because I was old enough to kind of make that decision. To step back, I have a brother that was born shortly before my parents divorced. He was, I think, 2.5, 3 at the time. My parents both agreed that my brother would go with my father. My mom had a brand new job. I mean, she had been a stay-at-home mom, so the work life for her was new. She really couldn't afford to have both of us, so they agreed that my brother would go with my father. My brother is very special to me. And I decided basically where my brother went, I would go. And so I went with my father as well. We moved to St. Louis and, you know, I finished high school there, went to college at William Woods University, ended up back in Houston doing research at MD Anderson Hospital. At that time, there was a very small gay neighborhood in Houston called Montrose. But it was not very safe after dark. I witnessed a really a gay bashing while I was having dinner with a friend of mine. You know, there was tall Victorian homes around the area, and it was not uncommon for people to get up onto the back decks and roofs of these houses and shoot at the fags. You know, they not really, I don't think, to kill, but really more to scare. But it became an area that, you know, you just didn't go to unless it was daytime. And when I was in medical school, there were a few people in my class that were gay or lesbian, and we knew not to say anything to anybody. You know, it was just a very closeted environment, and I just really got tired of that. And when I was a fourth-year medical student, I had the opportunity to come to San Francisco and do some electives. And, you know, it was just like, oh my goodness, there's actually a place in this world that people can hold hands and walk down the street and feel comfortable. And so from that moment on, I knew that I had to come back to San Francisco. It was a combination of being fearful, but also in hindsight, realizing how much energy you spend trying to stay closeted. You know, you never use pronouns. You don't really talk about what you did the night before, the weekend, or during the summer, because you just are worried that you're going to say the wrong pronoun or you're the wrong name, or, you know, it's everything is we did this or they, you know, it's never he or she or so it was time to leave Houston.
Thank you for giving us that. Powerful. I can just feel that what you're talking about, the closing in of your essence and who you are, you know, and it happens and it's still happening. So thank you for sharing that, Deb. Andre, give us a little bit of your journey growing up and coming out.
Growing up in upstate New York, initially I was just myself and my younger brother. Financially, my parents were getting by. They were renting the upper flat in a home. And so 8, 9 years after I was born and my brother John, my mother all of a sudden became, you know, got pregnant. And not only pregnant, but got pregnant with twins. It was a real change for the family, but we obviously needed to move out of there and go someplace else. So we moved pretty much across the street in this little town in upstate New York and somehow managed to buy a house. But my father literally worked 2 and 3 jobs for years to make ends meet. So he, you know, I'd see him, he'd come home Friday nights and then he'd be gone Sundays, and that went on for a long, long time. I had the 3 brothers, and my father was ex-army. He went through the war and everything else and was very much a sort of a macho kind of guy. So he essentially raised me as he raised the other boys. So I have a bigger toolbox than my brothers combined. And he made sure that I knew how to use every single tool that he had in his huge work shed and toolbox. And I was certainly able to do that, and to this day continue to be proud of my toolbox with all my tools in it. I feel kind of butch when I can take out my hammer or my pliers. So
put that tool belt on.
Yeah. In any case, really growing up, I don't think I felt anything different. I just felt like one of the guys until I was 14, and my swim instructor, by this point, I'd moved along through the Red Cross certification and, you know, was beyond frogs and minnows and all of that. Was up to the shark level, getting close to whale, and then, you know, how the Red Cross does all of that.
So. I don't, but thank you for the education.
You start off, right? You know, you're a minnow, you're a tadpole, then you're a minnow, and then you're a frog, and then you go to, I think shark is next, and then you get to whale, and then after that you can go and get your Red Cross certification to be a lifeguard. So I did all of that. So I think I was in the shark level at that point. But my swim instructor, who was really the head lifeguard, she used to drive me home from, you know, swim instructions, which was great. And this one day she said, I just need to go home and lie down. I'm exhausted. It was so hot in the sun. So we go to her house, and she lies down, and I'm just kind of sitting there in her bedroom with her, and I'm looking at her on the bed, and I'm thinking, gee, I'd really like to go lie down with her, which is the first time I ever felt this. And then I felt, where did that come from? In any case, I just sat there and twiddled my thumbs or did what I could do to not go and lie down next to her. In any case, so she took me home and, you know, went on from there. And I, you know, went on. And as a kid, again, we had no money. So my brother John and I had a paper route, and we'd get up every morning at about 3:30, 3:45, and take the papers to everybody in the little town. And that went on, you know, for years, and often that was the only money we had that we collected from the paper route, and Mom really had to struggle to get by. It went on, graduated high school, went to an all-girls Catholic school, which was sweet. In many ways, I still have a couple of friends from there. We get together a lot, and one good friend in particular, a lesbian, now lives in Washington State, but we've always kept in touch. And anyway, I went off to university and in college, and, you know, never really dated men. It just didn't even occur to me, but, you know, was on the women's basketball team at the university and played a lot of that, and that was kind of fun. Mm-hmm. All these girls in the locker room. But still, I don't think I hadn't put a handle on what it was. I just knew that it was different. You know, guys were not part of what I did. Then I went off to pharmacy school, and that was great, very demanding, very challenging. When I finished about 2 years later, I bought into a pharmacy with the fellow who had hired me when I was just a student in pharmacy school. And a few months later, this young pharmacy student came in and asked if we needed any help, because she had to do hours just like we all did while you're in school. And I was immediately attracted to this woman. And I said, well, we were looking for someone. I said, how did you know that we needed help? She said, well, I don't know. I just came by and I thought I'd come in. So there's, you know, kismet to all sorts of things. Fast forward, I hired her, certainly not long after that she moved in, and she was considerably younger than me, actually about 9 years, that wasn't too bad. But so she moved in with me and finished her pharmacy school, and we lived together for 8 or 9 years, totally closeted. I mean, there was, you know, it was just like I was the older friend who'd given her a job, and I could help with the rent, and, you know, all of those excuses you make is you know, again, the excuses you make so that people don't get it. So we'd always say, oh, we each had our own bedroom in the apartment, and this was Elaine's, and this was mine. And it was just a matter, financially, it was reasonable. And everybody in the family and everyone we knew bought it, and it made sense. I was making more money. I had this pharmacy, et cetera, et cetera. And so we lived like that for years, very, very closeted. Then, as it turns out, you know, Elaine was not a lesbian, but she just was in love with me. And after 8 or 9 years, told me that, you know, she wanted to have children and didn't see any way that we could obviously do this. And, you know, we separated. So she left. And, you know, we've always stayed good friends. And she indeed did get married.
She actually still really cares for you. You know, she named her daughter after you. And you're the godmother to Carolyn. So that's pretty cool as well. And she's good friends with me, and her husband is very good friends with us. And we've spent some good times together, you know, in Montreal, San Francisco, and also in Ottawa over the years. So very good.
Thank you for sharing that, Andre. And so, when did your parents and your dad, when did they say it was okay that you came out to them? I'm curious.
So my father, I'm sure he turns in his grave knowing that his four children. Three boys and one girl, we are all gay. The twin boys are gay. My younger brother, John, was gay. And I, obviously, you know, am a lesbian. And I'm sure, I mean, at one point, I think he probably had some suspicions. But, you know, we never came out and told him. We might bring the girl with me when I went to see him. But it was never a question of... My brothers were the same way. My brothers, the twins, came out to my mother, came out to her basically saying, you know, Mom, I just don't like girls. I'm not going out with that young woman. I'm going out with this and that. So they were very blunt with Mom. I never really said anything until my decision to leave Montreal to come here came up. And I called my mother to say I was moving to San Francisco. And she said, why are you doing that? And I said, well, I've met someone. And she said, who? And I told her the person's name. And it was a woman's name. And my mother hung the phone up on me. So I just held the phone and said, shoot, what? So I held the phone for a little bit, looked at it, and hung it up. And I thought, well, either she'll call me back or we'll figure this out. So about 10 minutes later, the phone did ring. And she called back and she said, I'm sorry, I don't understand, but I will support you. That was that. And I moved to San Francisco, and, you know, it's pretty much all history after that.
We want to thank you both so much for bringing yourselves, for being vulnerable, for letting us in a little bit to your lives. We appreciate this so much. What a gift to our community. Mm-hmm. We do have to end our interview now. So we were wondering if you had words of wisdom for our listeners, like thinking of your journey and someone who's listening that maybe beginning their journey. What could you say to help them or... Anything that's on your mind that you want the listeners to know? Debbie?
It's a phrase that my father told me. He knew that I was a lesbian long before I did. And when I came out to him, he hugged me and told me that he was proud that I had finally figured out who I was. And he said to me, always remember that when you are yourself and you are true to yourself, you're acting like a pebble in a pond. And when you throw a pebble in a pond, it makes ripples. And as more and more pebbles get thrown in, more and more ripples are made. And so if that first ripple is being truthful, all of the rest of the ripples will also, and it will expand beyond just that one little pebble, but it will expand to those around you. I thank my dad for really helping me discover who I am.
Mm-hmm. Special. Thank you. And Andre?
I've always felt that, you know, we don't want to be judged as gay people, but I also feel that for some people you need to give them space. And just like my mother, who hung the phone up on me, she needed some space to go to herself. What did I do wrong? Which is what she felt for the longest time. It's her fault that all her children were gay, which I think we all know is not the case. But I think they were trying to find a way to put the blame on something or on somebody. And they're thinking they didn't do anything wrong. But, you know, people need their space. And maybe it's because I'm an older lesbian, but I do feel that you need to cut people a little slack. I've never been a militant gay person. I'm not going to go out and march on the streets. You know, I'm going to be honest and clear. I'm going to be a person with a sense of ethics and do the right thing to everybody. And I feel that if you live your life like that, then that will come back to you. And those people will eventually realize that, hey, maybe she's a lesbian, but you know what? She's okay. Or maybe he's a gay guy, but look at him. He's just fabulous. So I think just that's my advice to people is do unto others as you would have them do to you.
Well, we want to thank you both so much for joining us tonight and allowing us, like I said, allowing us into your lives a little bit. Mm-hmm. We want you to remember that like Andre and Debbie, you too can be living proof that through sharing your story, you can support others in being free and living their lives authentically. It's another way to help the world. This is Diana and Sheridan, and we'll be back next month. Until then,
good night.
I step out of the ordinary. I can feel my soul ascending. I'm on my way. Can't stop me now. Then you can do the same. Yeah. What have you done today to make you feel proud? It's never.
Never too late to try. What have you done today to make So do it today, yeah. 'Cause I can see you.
Did you know that there are more than 2,000 people living with HIV and AIDS in Sonoma County? 500 of them don't know they have it, so neither do their partners. HIV is a treatable condition, but it's important to find out early if you have the virus. Knowing your HIV status can be life-saving for you and those you love. There's an easy way to find out your status. Face2Face offers free, anonymous HIV testing with results in just 20 minutes. Visit the Face2Face office at 873 2nd Street in Santa Rosa. No appointment is needed. For more information, call 544-1581 or visit f2f.org. We want you to know your status. Face2Face, ending AIDS in Sonoma County, 20 minutes at a time.
Last night, pre-flight, 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much, I miss my life. It's lonely out in space on such a timeless flight. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time till touchdown brings me round again to find I'm not gonna make. Ain't the kind of place to raise your kids. In fact, it's cold as hell, and there's no one there to raise them. If you did, and all this science I don't understand. It's just my job 5 days a week. Or I can't. I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh, no, no, no.
That was Taryn Egerton and Sebastian Rich with Rocket Man from the Rocket Man soundtrack. Tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Music with Cheryl Kabanuk. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on Radio 91. And if you missed one of our past shows, are a new listener, or want to share a show with a friend, you can find many of our previous programs available for on-demand play at any time on our website at outbeatradio.com. KRCB mobile app is an ideal way to take Outbeat Radio and KRCB with you when you travel this summer. It's available to download free of charge right now for your Apple and Android devices. On air, online, and on the go. You're listening to Radio 91, 91.1 KRCB FM Windsor, and 90.9 K215 CQ Santa Rosa, a service of Northern California Public Media. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Afropop is next.